You've had a dynamic where money's become freer than free.
If you talk about a Fed just gone nuts, all the central banks going nuts.
So it's all acting like safe haven.
I believe that in a world where central bankers are tripping over themselves to devalue their currency, Bitcoin wins. In the world of fiat currencies, Bitcoin is the victor.
I mean, that's part of the bull case for Bitcoin.
If you're not paying attention, you probably should be.
Very interesting times. And like I was just saying, it seems like we're getting to see a lot of your theses play out in real time as Trump takes over as president here. Again. Well, and I think within the last 48 hours, too, there's been this talk of tariffs, and I've seen you discuss the topic of tariffs on other shows and whether or not they'd actually be beneficial or counterproductive to Trump's ultimate goals. And I think with what happened with Colombia over the weekend may signal that tariffs are nothing more than a bargaining chip to force people to the table when he wants certain things out of certain countries. And so what was your take on the Colombia and the levying of tariffs and Colombia bending the knee within 12 hours?
You know, I mean, what I saw of it was, you know, they said they weren't going to do it. And then he threatened a whole laundry list of things, not least of which that I thought was the IEEPA tariffs, which I don't think a lot of people understand what those are. But those are something signed, I guess, by President Carter. And it's basically, we'll take your treasuries. And I don't think people understand, you know, or we'll place levies or we'll freeze your treasuries or we'll place a levy on them or we'll do something that will make that you will not be able to use them. And yeah, Colombia said, hey, we'll send jets to get our people back. Their president or prime minister or whatever also sent a pretty wild tweet, basically. I thought it was, I don't know if it was just sound and fury signifying nothing or just trying to sort of get the last word in. But, you know, what I thought about it is I don't think it's going to go as smoothly as a lot of people think. You know, there's sort of a lot of, you know, hurrah, we're finally pushing people around. As I got on, Christine Freeland in Canada said, let's form a coalition of everybody that Trump's going after. The Germans of today announced that Volkswagen's factories may start to be taken over by the Chinese, their electric car factories. And so I think this may be messier than people think. And with the Colombia situation, I think we just got our second message in 3 years that treasuries are no longer safe. If you're a foreigner, why would you ever store your FX reserves and treasuries now? You've had warnings from Iran, from Russia, and now Colombia. So we know, you know, I think it's an interesting move ahead of what is a lot of treasury supply to come here in the first half of the year. You know, we'll see. Ultimately, look, I think it's going to be good for America because foreigners aren't buying foreign. If the foreign official sector is not buying these things, then rates are going to go up and rates can't go much up beyond 5% on 10-year treasuries before things implode. And we know they're not going to let things implode for very long, which means, you know, the Fed will have to buy them or Treasury have to buy them. You know, someone's going to have to print dollars and buy them to cap yields. And that's really good for, you know, it's what has to happen. That's going to weaken the dollar. That's going to drive, that's going to force gold and maybe Bitcoin into more of a neutral reserve asset role. It'll drive nominal growth. It'll drive inflation. And, you know, in the long run, that's good. But, you know, we'll see.
Yeah. I think that's been pretty clear to me, at least, with Trump presidency number two and the ambitious goals he has, particularly on the economic side of things and the way in which he wants to go about it, particularly with high tariffs, low income tax. And as you've been describing on many of the shows that you've been on, that could lead to dollar strength, which is counterproductive to his goals ultimately. But maybe if his goal is to create a liquidity crisis to rationalize a big print, then that's what's going to happen. And then you have, again, a crazy weekend. There's Colombia and then the emergence of DeepSeek, the hottest chick on the AI block. And from I've been having a lot of conversations behind the scenes over the last 3 days, and it's a mix of maybe it's a nothing burger to it is probably the biggest thing that's happened in the world of AI in the last 3 years, in the sense that it could destroy a lot of capital overnight, a lot of capital, tens of billions, hundreds of billions of dollars allocated towards these Western AI companies for CapEx and infrastructure that may ultimately prove to be unnecessary. And I think the timing of the DeepSeek launch and the open sourcing of their models was very interesting, considering that Trump did this massive press meeting with Sam Altman, Larry Ellison, Masa, and then 2 days later, where they said they're going to invest $500 billion over the course of 4 years. And then 2 days later, it's like, oh, you're going to invest that much? You don't even need that much. You need $6
billion. Yeah, it's interesting. People who understand that space better than me that I've talked to, you know, I said, what is it? I've seen everywhere from it's a cruise missile into, you know, to the heart of AI infrastructure to, you know, the Chinese cheated and lied about it. And, you know, their answer was, it's kind of both. You know, on one hand, they didn't spend $6 million, right? There seems to have been a lot more spent in all likelihood. And it's entirely possible that some of it, according to some people in the industry, that, you know, it could have been, you know, they scraped the web scraper, right? So if OpenAI got a bunch of data from scraping the web, and, you know, maybe DeepSeek scraped OpenAI. We'll really know when DeepSeek does their next version, that if it's incremental and not scraped, then I think there'll be sort of round two of sort of freaking out about this. But what those people said was, even if all that's true, so what? The real story is still that somehow the Chinese, with their collapsing stock market and their collapsing home prices and, you know, how screwed they all are, according to the Western media, managed to do this. And it's a very big, it calls into question a lot of narratives about China, as it should. They were able to come up with something like this. They were able to release something like this. And I think it, in a major way, reduces U.S. leverage, right? I mean, at the end of the day, this, we know this exists now. And let's say we don't know that it isn't just a scraped version of OpenAI. We're going to know that. Once we know that it's not just a scraped version of OpenAI, and I don't have an opinion one way or another because I'm not, you know, I'm not in that business enough to know the difference. But let's assume that it's not. If we assume that it's not, when you sit down with allies like Scott Bessent to say he's going to do, what do you have to offer? We've suddenly gone from, hey, we have AI and they don't, to, well, you know, China buys 434 million smartphones and we buy 140 million, but we have AI, they have AI, and they build 30 million cars and we build 10 million cars, but sanction them and come with us. We're the bigger market. We're not the bigger market. We're not. And they're still not even consuming per capita what we are. So it's a really interesting dynamic as it relates to leverage, you know, and then it gets down to, okay, well, come with us or else we're going to, you know, you saw today Trump pulling 20,000 troops out of the EU, allegedly or reportedly. So it starts to get very transactional. It starts to get very confrontational. And so I think it's a big moment from that standpoint of just sort of the, you know, potentially, again, assuming that it's not just scraped, which I don't know for sure one way or another. Let's see. It's a big non sequitur to sort of the consensus view of, look, we're dominant in this and the Chinese are light years behind us. And that might not be true. And if that's not true, then it follows that the U.S. leverage that it thinks it has to push people around the world as it sits down and says, choose us or choose China. Maybe those conversations get delayed a little because they might not like the answer from our allies, adversaries, et cetera, et cetera.
Now, it seems very clear to me that we need to eat some humble pie. And it seems like we're getting mixed signals in both good and bad directions from the administration. I think Scott Bessent, particularly during the Senate hearings about his approval to become Treasury Secretary, I think his framing of the energy race that we're in was perfect. And that's really what it comes down to. Like, if, because we've already sanctioned China in a way with NVIDIA where we're not allowing them to buy NVIDIA chips, and they can use the power of the electricity base that they have with older computers to get the same results that we have here in the United States, because we are inherently behind in the energy.
Possibly. And, you know, I've seen credible people say, look, there's no way they did these with these older chips. And what really happened is all that business that NVIDIA was reporting as going through Singapore was actually very high end cutting edge chips going into China through Singapore. And in that case, the message is you can't even force your own sanctions anymore in the U.S. So, like, it's one of two things, neither of which reflect very well on the relative power of the United States at this moment in time, which is either the Chinese can use their electricity and crappier chips to come up with something better, or the U.S. can't even enforce its sanctions on China. And you say, well, we just need to be tougher under Trump. And, like, that's fine. Then we'll get a lot more days like today in the NASDAQ. And after, you know, a few more $500 billion market cap losses in NVIDIA and another couple trillion in the NASDAQ, we'll have a recession. And once we have a recession, the deficit will blow out. Deficit blows out. We're going to have a treasury market issue. And now what do you want to do? You know, because, oh, by the way, Trump has, that's his scoreboard. Stock market going down every day is his scoreboard. And so the scoreboard's going to say, you suck, you suck, you suck. You're losing, you're losing, you're losing. He doesn't take well to that very well. So it's a really interesting dynamic that this introduces, in my opinion, this whole story, relative to sort of the prevailing zeitgeist going into it.
Yeah. And I had a conversation last week with Larry Lepard on the show, and he made a very good point, which is these losses on the scoreboard that you were just describing, the hit that the market took today, there is a window of time. Is it 3 months? Is it 6 months? Is it a whole year where you can blame that on the previous administration? But after a certain point, the onus is going to be on him to produce results. And I guess that's the big question on everybody's mind, whether it's DeepSeek, the energy situation, the treasury situation, is how do we get out of this morass? And going back to Scott Bessent, I'm really interested to get your thoughts on him, because he's been speaking openly for the better part of a year about wanting to be in a position of power that he's in now so that he can help navigate the U.S. through this tumultuous time and help thread the needle to reset things and get us back on a path towards prosperity.
Yeah, you know, we wrote a report for clients at the beginning of December that said all three of his three arrows all require a weaker dollar. And so it's fascinating to me. There's been this dynamic of, like, the dollar's going to go stronger, stronger. And mechanically, I understand why that is the case in terms of what tariffs would do and what the Fed may do and et cetera. But at the end of the day, Bessent's three arrows can't happen without a weaker dollar. And I think there has been a misunderstanding amongst a lot of market participants who've heard Trump say, I want to maintain reserve status of the dollar, heard what Bessent was said to say by the headlines, but didn't really read the stories in the Wall Street Journal and FT, which was that, you know, he's in favor of a strong dollar and maintaining reserve dollar system. But what he really said was, I'm in favor of a strong dollar system, but a strong dollar system and a weak dollar are not mutually exclusive. He said that almost verbatim. And he's further said that he wants to rebalance trade between China and the U.S. That can't happen with a weaker yuan and a stronger dollar. Mechanically, axiomatically, it can't. You need a stronger yuan and a weaker dollar. He said, we need China to consume more, the U.S. to produce more. That's weaker dollar, stronger yuan. So then you can get into questions about how to do it. But I ultimately think he understands that you need to move back to some sort of system with a neutral reserve asset around which the yuan rises and the dollar falls. And like I said, there's a lot of ways you can do that. But ultimately, I think he will end up getting the dollar much weaker. You know, I know he wants energy cheaper, oil in particular, cheaper. I think that's a pipe dream. I hear credible rumblings that the energy secretary knows that's a pipe dream. You know, Chris Wright. And so, you know, maybe, you know, when Bessent says 3 million barrels of oil equivalent growth by the end of Trump's term, you know, oil equivalent might be doing a lot of heavy lifting there. So I don't know what he's including in that in his own mind. Is that, you know, is that liquefied natural gas? Is that NGL, you know, NGLs, natural gas liquids? Is that nuclear power equivalents in terms of barrels of, you know, in terms of BTUs? I don't know. But if he's talking about oil and he's talking about taking oil to 50, oil at 50 and growing oil 3 million barrels a day by the end of Trump's term, those are fundamentally incompatible. That ain't going to happen. And I've been hearing that from numerous different people throughout the shale patches. It's not going to happen. So, you know, is that we're going to annex Canada and count that? I mean, who knows? Maybe I don't know what they're, you know, there's, like I said, oil equivalent maybe doing all the heavy lifting there. So, you know, as I look at Bessent's, you know, three arrows, which is get the deficit down, you know, to 3% by the end of the term, 3 million barrels a day. And then I think the other one was 3% real growth is the last one. None of them can happen unless the dollar's a lot weaker, full stop. And then the only question is sort of how do you do that? And then when you look at what he said about China and what he said about the U.S. in terms of rebalancing and restructuring the system, that too suggests the dollar's got to go down against the yuan. So what's really interesting about all that is that sort of like 180 degrees opposite of where Wall Street consensus is, where investing consensus is, which is like, oh, Bessent's in there, it's gonna be strong dollar. And I strongly disagree.
What's up, freaks? This is Nat. You don't want to skip because Fold has a great offer for you. Everyone knows about Fold, the app where you can earn the most Bitcoin rewards for everyday purchases. I did this yesterday. Me and my wife, we use Amazon to buy quite a few things. And instead of just putting our credit card into Amazon and buying there, I put my credit card into Fold and buy an Amazon gift card and upload it to Amazon. Why? Because I get the credit card points and then I get sats back. Yesterday, I bought a gift card. I made 10,181 sats, about $10.50 in Bitcoin. And it's the only way to do it. If you want to stack Bitcoin passively, make sure you're using Fold gift cards. Fold has a special deal. I mentioned it earlier. If you're not shopping with Fold gift cards, you're leaving sats on the table. New users that sign up to Fold are going to get 20,000 sats in a welcome bonus with their first gift card purchase. So don't leave sats on the table. Sign up now at foldapp.com/Marty. Get those 20,000 sats, freaks. Sup, freaks. This rip of TFTC was brought to you by our good friends at BitKey. BitKey makes Bitcoin easy to use and hard to lose. It is a hardware wallet that natively embeds into a 2 or 3 multi-sig. You have one key on the hardware wallet, one key on your mobile device, and Block stores a key in the cloud for you. This is an incredible hardware device for your friends and family, or maybe yourself who have Bitcoin on exchanges and have for a long time, but haven't taken the step to self-custody because they're worried about the complications of setting up a private public key pair, securing that seed phrase, setting up a PIN, setting up a passphrase. Again, BitKey makes it easy to use, hard to lose. It's the easiest 0-to-1 step, your first step to self-custody. If you have friends and family on the exchanges who haven't moved it off, tell them to pick up a BitKey. Go to bitkey.world, use the key TFTC20 at checkout for 20% off your order. That's bitkey.world, code TFTC20.
So that begs the question, what leads to a weaker dollar? Is it obviously a liquidity crisis that necessitates a big print? And if you look at reverse repo markets, commercial real estate delinquency rates, you could see, the problem of 2023 rearing its head again, which is the banking system's reserves are heavily backed by U.S. treasuries with yields going higher. Like, is that what you think is going to necessitate a big print? Is just a banking liquidity crisis again?
I don't think it'll be a banking liquidity crisis per se. I think it'll be, I suppose it could be. I mean, the fundamental thing to me, it's a fiscal crisis, right? I mean, the big gear we've been watching on that front is U.S. true interest expense as a percent of U.S. federal tax receipts. And anytime that number gets close to 100%, the dollar goes up, 10-year yields go up, and, you know, that stocks, everything else goes down except for maybe gold until we have, you know, sort of the big print. So could that be it again? Sure, especially since as of right now, we're at 111% true interest expense as a percent of receipts. Like, U.S. government cannot cover out of receipts its entitlements and its interest. And we're about to reprice a bunch of interest higher in the first half of this year. So that I think alone is enough to cause the problem. And we've been nervous really since, I would say, probably end of December, mid-end December, of, hey, all right, we're now at whatever, 100% plus true interest expense as a percent of receipts. That's great for the dollar. It's good for gold. It's good for nothing else. And that, I think, will continue to be the case until they do inject that dollar liquidity, whatever that looks like. Now, there's lots of ways mechanically you could do that, not least of which is the Fed cutting rates when they shouldn't be, because, by the way, inflation is picking back up. Growth is picking back up. That's one way you could do it. There's other things you could do mechanically, but ultimately, the fiscal situation requires a much weaker dollar by the end of this year. And so, you know, until they get it there, the beatings are going to continue, I think.
Yeah, what do we have to roll over? $6 trillion this year?
Sounds about right. I don't know the number off the top of my head, but it's a big number.
Yeah. Now, if rates are at this level, you imagine the slope on the curve of interest expense is going to go up dramatically. Like, just surpass defense spending, you could see it quickly outpacing.
I think a lot of investors have just overcomplicated things, which is to say, I think investing right now is a one decision tree. You know, maybe there's a tactical view and a strategic view. So let's break that down. It's the one question is, do you think the United States will stop trying to be hegemonic because its interest is above its defense budget? And if you think the United States will, for lack of printing dollars that it can print, then by all means, you should be in, you know, only in cash and reposition your portfolio for a recession, and you should, you know, be very defensively positioned. Tactically, that could be the case. You know, to your point, maybe Trump wants to create that for a moment to sort of, you know, kill a chicken to scare the monkeys, or to get policies, or to set himself up for the big print, or whatever that may be. But strategically, and when I say strategically, I mean beyond the next 2 to 3 months, I think there's no chance the United States government says, oh, we're going to cede Eurasia to China and Russia. We're going to cut defense spending to make room for interest. We're going to cut entitlements to make room for interest. There's no chance that's going to happen. And if that's not going to happen, then one way or another, they're going to print the money to pay the interest. And ultimately, that kind of gets back to our overriding theme, which is the U.S. needs a 2 to 3 year period of real interest rates that are probably close to negative double digits, maybe negative teens. In other words, nominal GDP growth, 10 to 15% above inflation for 2 to 3 years. That's how we get out of this. And I don't care how they get it, but that's what's coming. And if you think that's not coming, then your bet is that the United States is going to allow its interest to force it to cut defense and cut entitlements under Trump. If that's your view, good luck. I don't think that's the view, but I think that's the decision ultimately is, do you think the Trump administration will cut defense and entitlements to make room for interest? And the interest is already bigger. The net interest, forget about gross. Gross is like 60, 70% bigger than defense. But net interest is above defense for the first time in at least 65, 70 years, probably all of American history. And as Neil Ferguson said, going back 300-400 years, once your interest goes above your defense, you stop being hegemonic in a big hurry. And so, you know, are we gonna just say, oh, we're not hegemonic anymore, darn? Or are we gonna inject liquidity, print dollars? I strongly think next 2 to 3 months, I have no view. Maybe we let everybody twist in the wind. Who knows? I have no strong view on that. But as I look out to, you know, the next 6, 9, 12, 18 months, I think there's almost no chance we don't print the money, inject the liquidity, however we do that. Cap yields, there's a lot of different ways you can do it. Conceivably, but I think that's what's going to happen. And I think that's really good for growth, inflation, gold, Bitcoin, America, wages, et cetera.
Yeah. And well, if you look at the gold price, I didn't check it today, but I remember Friday it was approaching 3,000, hitting new all-time highs. That's the leading indicator, right? I think even more so than Bitcoin at this point.
Yeah, and I think ultimately Bitcoin will separate from the NASDAQ. I think that'll be, especially if the NASDAQ stuff keeps up, I think that's a surprise coming for a lot of people that are negative on Bitcoin, saying, oh, it's just a beta play on NASDAQ. I think if we keep this up for another few weeks in the NASDAQ, I think you'll see Bitcoin separate from NASDAQ, but let's see. But yeah, gold ultimately is telling you. I mean, this the fact that it went out Friday at over $2,800, all-time high, in dollars in every currency, record in every currency, it's telling you they're going to cut rates when they, to make room to pay the deficit.
Yeah. Do you envision a Bretton Woods 2.0 that's also been floating around in the context of Ascent, is that he's publicly stated he would be open to a Bretton Woods like agreement where you get to the table and reset everything?
Yeah, I think it's very possible. And if it's going to happen, I would say it's probably going to happen in the first half of this year. Because if you're going to do it, it's going to be pretty disruptive and ultimately very good for the U.S., ultimately very good for growth. So if you're going to do it, you want to do it with sufficient lead time ahead of midterms 2026. And so if you do it in the first half of this year, global growth, U.S. growth will be absolutely humming by the time midterms come around. And so I think if it's going to happen, I think it'll be in the first half of this year. And I think there's a deal to be had. I mean, Yellen kind of hinted at it. Bessent has hinted at it. But it's ultimately around stronger yuan, weaker dollar, higher Chinese consumption, more U.S. production, which are sort of some of the key themes we've talked about. But I think it's all on the there to be had. Will it happen? Who knows? But I do think it's possible.
How would it happen? Like, how would you get everybody at the table and make sure that an agreement is reached in which each party is sufficiently happy with the outcome?
I think there's only two parties that really matter, maybe three. And I think that's U.S., China, Russia. And everyone else would kind of have to go along to get along. And so that makes it easier. I think the deal to be had is essentially the dollar is weakened. The dollar and yuan are both weakened against gold markedly. The dollar more than the yuan, so that the dollar actually falls against the yuan, but they both fall against gold. And then I think you devalue oil relative to gold. In other words, today gold trades at about 40 barrels, 38 barrels of oil per ounce. I think the grand deal to be had is gold goes to 100 barrels of oil per ounce. And then, China wants the equivalent. China needs cheaper oil because they import all theirs, basically. And the U.S. wants more expensive oil because the U.S. wants to be able to produce more. And it's price sensitive. And so I think you get, $100 per barrel oil, or 100 barrel per oil gold. And the price of oil in the U.S. is 70, and the price of oil in China is the equivalent of 50. And when you sort of shake all that out, and then we devalue the dollar, maybe you can work that out. That hey, that's it's a much cheaper dollar relative to yuan through the gold pivot. Or you could even simplify right now. Yuan has devalued against gold in the last 27 months by 65%. Gold in yuan terms is 20,000 yuan. If you take the dollar to $5,000 gold today, that would be four, right? That would be a yuan dollar of four through the cross rate of gold. 20,000 yuan, $5,000, 20,000 divided by five is four. So yuan would rise from 7.25 where it is today to four, which almost nobody on Wall Street thinks could ever happen, by the way. But that would incent more consumption for China. That would incent more production for the U.S., and it would rebalance things in the way that Bessent has noted. And it would be happen in a way that it makes Russia happy because they've got a bunch of gold and they got a bunch of oil. OPEC is fine with that because they got a bunch of gold. The Indians got a bunch of gold. So oil got a lot cheaper in gold terms. They're okay. nobody else really matters. They don't have a say.
This rip was brought to you by our great friends at Unchained. As Bitcoin's role in the global financial landscape evolves, understanding its potential impact on your wealth becomes increasingly crucial. Whether we see measured adoption or accelerated hyper-Bitcoinization, being prepared for various scenarios can make the difference between merely participating and truly optimizing your position. This is important, freaks. This is why Unchained developed the Bitcoin Calculator, a sophisticated modeling tool that helps you visualize and prepare for multiple Bitcoin futures. Beyond traditional retirement planning, it offers deep insights into how different adoption scenarios could transform your wealth trajectory. What sets this tool apart is the integration with the Unchained IRA, the only solution that combines the tax advantages of a retirement account with the security of self-custody. In any future state, maintaining direct control of your keys remains fundamental to your Bitcoin strategy. Go explore the potential futures at unchained.com/TFTC. Bitcoin is going up. Make sure you're protecting it the right way. Make sure you have a good partner. That is Unchained. Go to unchained.com/TFTC.
So Europe's getting the shit out of the stick here.
Yeah. The Europeans to me have been such a disappointment.
It's really astonishing.
I say that as someone of German descent, like their leaders have been so bad, just so bad. Like all you needed to do was keep your nukes open, keep buying Russian crude. Don't let the Americans talk you into doing dumb stuff and keep buying energy, you know, keep your nukes open and buy energy, cheap energy from Russia and euros, and you're fine. That's the winning strategy. And they tried to buy oil from Saddam in euros. We didn't let that happen. We didn't let it happen for long, at least. They wanted to buy gas from Russia in euros. We didn't really let, someone didn't let that happen, right? The Nord Stream 2 pipeline Epstein itself somehow. Oh, how'd that happen? And so some of that is, you know, because their leaders were naive and didn't want to invest in military of their own, or they liked having the American military bases there because they were economic stimulus. And they've been just so disappointing in terms of their strategic, more recently, their strategic dynamics, right? This whole green thing is just silly. In terms of and look, I'm in favor of the environment, blah, blah, blah. End of the day, you can't run an economy if you don't have cheap baseload power, full stop, especially if you're a manufacturing economy. I got 43 solar panels on my roof, but, you know, I'm in Ohio, so it's not that different a latitude to Germany. Like, I love my solar panels. They make things a little cheaper. Would I want to only run? No, I've also got natural gas main, natural gas, and a backup natural gas powered generator. So like, it just is so, they've made too many bad decisions to have a seat at the table. They have completely given away their autonomy.
Yeah, it's a real shame.
Yeah, it is. And maybe they'll get it back someday. I don't know. Maybe not. But, you know, the problem is that the people that are actually common sense about it are deemed right wingers, right?
Yeah.
Like, you look at the economic policies of like AfD in Germany, like they're totally like, hey, let's stop war. Let's go back to fossil fuels and buy some, you know, gas from, you know, maybe from Russia, and let's turn the nukes back. Like, you know, yet they're deemed Nazis, right? Like, it's like, I'm pretty sure that's not far right. No. Like, it's common sense.
It seems like the people on the ground are getting pissed off enough that an issue could be forced, but yeah. It's a shame. And I think Davos World Economic Forum meeting last week was pretty illuminating in terms of how that class of your European plutocrats, yeah, it does seem like they think they've lost. I mean, there was the one speech where it was explicitly said Trump winning this election and people welcoming the executive orders that he's signing is a clear sign that we've been wrong and maybe we should think about that. And hopefully they are taking that advice to heart because, yeah, Europe is in a terrible place right now in terms of the global geopolitical spectrum.
It is. And you know, it's really interesting because some of what we have done, we being the U.S., we're in a great power competition with China. You know, we're in this whatever it is with Russia, I don't know, proxy war pissing contest. I don't know. But strategically, one of our biggest allies in theory was Europe. And so our strategy over the last 8 years has been to basically push Russia toward China, which is a mistake, and then to effectively carpet bomb, economically carpet bomb Europe, our biggest ally, which is, I don't know, it's either a mistake or not a mistake, right? I mean, it's you know, to the extent it forces their industry to come here, then it's not a mistake, but then you just got to let them go, right? Then you don't take them on as a welfare state, because then it drags you down, right? When you know, if you're barely keeping your head afloat after a shipwreck, you don't try to sort of prop up a drowning man. You got to let him go, because he'll drown you too. And that's the same kind of dynamic. So it's a tough situation, but yeah, they sort of made their bed. Now they got to lie in it, I guess. Europeans, that is.
Yeah. No, it's very similar to the inner workings of the European Union too. You have all these northern economies subsidizing the southern economies, which are dragging them down. And
it's almost reversing now, right? Like the southern ones have taken their medicine and in some ways are starting to subsidize the northern ones. And there are some things they could in theory do. You know, they could revalue gold, they could start buying energy in their own currency and you know, net settle in gold with. But again, they are so far from that point. They have to basically make up with Russia. They've got to change certain relationships in the Middle East. And then they still have a competitive problem against China. And that's why I say, like, they're a drowning man. Like, hey, we're going to buy American LNG. Great. That's great. Except it's very expensive. And in the meantime, we've made Russian LNG, not even LNG, it's pipeline gas, right? So it's cheaper by definition. You're never going to get cheaper LNG than pipeline gas and Russian pipeline gas unless you're selling it at a huge loss, subsidized by the American taxpayer, than what China's getting from Russia. So China's industry is going to have a permanent advantage against European industry. And the European industry is heavily northern weighted. So, like, they're in a bad way. And, you know, so it's not surprising to me that you're getting these series of political turnover in Europe and in the UK that you are. But it's, you know, it's like that meme where it's like, you know, you're not wrong. The world is, or whatever, right? The guy looking at the mirror, it's like their leaders are like, it's not me. It's that all of our people are Nazis and extremists. It's like, wake up. But they haven't woken up yet. And so, you know, the beatings will continue until either, you know, they're really screwed, or until the leaders wake up, or they get a leader in there who knows what they're doing.
Yeah. Hopefully they wake up. Spin up the nukes, Europe. It's time. I think that's their only last ditch effort they have to try to leapfrog any perceived competition or get back to a stable base. But you mentioned the repricing of gold, and that's been a topic over here in the United States, particularly as it pertains to the strategic Bitcoin reserve bill that Cynthia Lummis wrote. And that's part of that bill. It's taking the Treasury's gold held at the Federal Reserve at $42 an ounce, repricing it, selling some to buy Bitcoin. What do you think the U.S. could do in terms of repricing gold and leveraging that ability to put us in better footing?
Oh, I think it's right there for the taking. It's a political courage issue. Just writing up the gold from 42 to wherever it is, 2,800 a day would be, I don't know, probably $700 billion worth of a write up. And the mechanics of it are, as I understand it, it's Treasury instructs Fed. Fed does it. All it amounts to basically using the gold to print money. And it creates a deposit into the Treasury general account that Bessent can spend however he sees fit. And so just writing it up the market would take care of, you know, $700 billion. We're going to run a $2 trillion deficit. Like, it's a huge slug of QE effectively year one, right? That's base case. If he wanted to be brave and do something really extreme, he can pick whatever number suits him. You know, you want to write the gold up. Every $4,000 up on the price of gold is another $1 trillion, right? So, you know, to market is $700 billion. From 2,800 to 7,000 is another, you know, $5,000, give or take. So that's, you know, every 4,000 is a trillion. So it's 1.25, right? So that's 1.25 trillion. So you write it from $42 to 5,000, there's like $2 trillion that you now can do whatever you want with. And if you want to get really aggressive and really position us to compete, you could write it up to 20,000. Write up to 20,000. There's about $5 trillion in gain, plus the $700 billion in write up from 42 to 2,800. Okay, great. There's $5.7 trillion. You could buy back some huge slug of the treasury market, delever the United States debt to GDP from 125% to a much smaller number virtually overnight. It would be basically the equivalent of straight money printing. And so it's going to be very inflationary, very good for nominal growth, very good for asset markets. And so debt to GDP could easily be taken down to 50% over a weekend, just like that. Like it was a Trump meme coin. Voila. I've asked multiple different Washington lobbyists if my interpretation of the Financial Accounting Manual for Federal Reserve Banks, Section 2.10, is incorrect. And I've been told by multiple different parties that my interpretation of that is correct. That, yes, all it requires is Treasury Secretary saying, write it up, Fed does it, and the money gets deposited free and clear. You're basically creating money supply without an offsetting increase in debt. Would they use it to buy Bitcoin? I don't know why you would. Like, if you want to buy Bitcoin, friggin' print the money and buy Bitcoin. I don't know why you need to sell. I wouldn't sell the gold, that's for sure. You know, this is just creating money using the gold as collateral, but I would never sell the gold. I don't know why you would do that. Because look, if we do go to World War III, ain't nobody taking dollars. I don't think we're going to World War III. But look, that's a tail risk. And during World War II, we didn't even take global reserve currency, British pounds, when we sold stuff to the Brits. Dollars or gold, that's it. No one would take our paper in war.
Yeah, I guess that's the game theoretic scenario and the incentive scenario that's been played out by Bitcoiners, is if you do have this struggle between the U.S., China, Russia, and China and Russia have this goal or idea to really reset the monetary landscape and use gold as the core asset of that. If you were to reprice the gold in the U.S., sell it, buy Bitcoin, you could throw a wrench in that by messing up the price of gold. But I guess that's pretty risky. And as you mentioned, why risk that if you can just print the money, buy Bitcoin, issue treasuries, buy Bitcoin, whatever it may be.
Well, you could do that, you know, but then what's the next move? And I've not heard a lot of Bitcoiners talk about this. What's the next move China and Russia would do? Well, it's easy. I now value, Russia just says, all right, I'll just revalue my oil in Bitcoin terms. And I'll buy the Bitcoin right back from you. Unless you can reduce your usage of my oil world. And the world, practically speaking, would collapse without Russian oil. If you take all Russian oil out of the market, the oil price goes to a price that the world's debt collapses. That's an economic collapse. So the world would basically have to pay whatever Bitcoin price Russia set it at. Ditto China's factories, right? At the end of the day, if we did that, we could, in theory, sort of do it once. But ultimately, then China goes, oh, okay, well, you know, we'll just revalue the price of our output relative to Bitcoin, and we'll just buy it all back. You know, we'll buy the Bitcoin back from you if that's what you want to use. Yeah. And I think both of them want to go to a neutral reserve asset. They've talked about it for years. And so there is Putin's on record saying you can't stop Bitcoin. That might be something he might find interesting to do. It would just be a version of what Sergei Glazyev talked about, actually citing Zoltan Pozsar a couple years ago, where Sergei Glazyev, one of Putin's economic advisors, said, hey, let's just revalue the price of oil. You know, instead of, at the time it was one. What was it? A barrel per gram? I think it was a barrel per gram. They just said, let's just make it 2 barrels a gram. Voila. We just doubled the price of gold. Same thing with Bitcoin. We could do that with Bitcoin. Just like, oh, it's, you know, whatever point, whatever bit, point, whatever Bitcoin per barrel. All right, we'll just go 0.3 whatever Bitcoin per barrel. Have a good day. Wave it in. We'll just buy it right back off you.
Yeah.
And if you don't like it, then we won't sell our oil to you. And if we don't buy our oil somewhere in the world, you know, and the Saudis would probably go, oh, that sounds great. Why would we, you know? And so there we go.
Yeah. I haven't thought of that. That would be fascinating. And we've been talking about this repricing gold, and I think it's important to get back to first principles here, because it was gold priced at $42 an ounce and held there for the amount of decades that it has been for this exact reason. Like, was it locked in at that price in the beginning with the foresight of a potential need to reprice it in the future? The whole being able to just hold gold at the Federal Reserve at $42 an ounce, just it while it's trading at $2,800, that confuses the hell out of me. Like, why is a price there? Like, was it to...
It's historical. Yeah. So you go back in history, for a long time, gold was $20 an ounce. And that was when the dollar was gold backed. And then in 33, FDR called in all the gold at 20 and then devalued it to 35. And you couldn't own gold, as it started to become illegal to own gold as an American domestically from 1933 to 1974. Gold was $35 an ounce as part of the Bretton Woods deal, 45. So it was, you know, basically the dollar is valued at $35 an ounce and all the other currencies are tied to the dollar. And then, you know, we sort of did the classic overprinting of dollars relative to our stash of $35 per ounce gold. And so we ended up having to revalue it from 35 to 42. I think that was in 1968 to basically relieve stress on the system, because the world was sort of doing the math of, hey, LBJ and Nixon, you're doing all this guns and butter, you know, stupid stuff, you know, Lyndon Johnson, Great Society, and spending a gazillion dollars in Vietnam, and you don't have the gold. Give us our gold. You take these dollars. And so at first, you know, they devalued the dollar from 35 an ounce to 42 an ounce, and that's where it still sits today. And then there was a choice, and there were serious people who thought we should further devalue the dollar from 42 an ounce to somewhere between 100 and 150 an ounce, to further sort of rebalance that system and keep the dollar on a gold-backed system. But the other proposal was just close the gold window. And that's what they obviously went with. And so the $42 per ounce price is just a legacy or a vestige of that. Now, basically everybody else in the world marks their gold to market on a quarterly or even monthly basis in their gold reserves. We're basically the only major nation that doesn't. The EU does it. The Russians do it. The Chinese do it. I think the Indians do it. But sort of a lot of our major counterparties do that already. And so I don't know why we haven't. I've heard different discussions around reasons for that. I think they're mostly dogmatic. You know, I have heard the conspiracy theory. I don't know how much, or the view. I don't even want to call it a conspiracy there, because the people who say it, I don't think are necessarily conspiratorial or minded, but I've never heard it before, which is that because we defaulted, right? We said we would make you good at $42 an ounce. I've heard it said that if we revalued the gold to seven, you know, to market, that would basically bring it, you know, put it back on the table, and that there are still existing claims on that gold at 42 to the Europeans mostly. And so if we said, and that can probably be fixed, I would suspect, with some sort of deal, or just, hey, you know, if you what are you going to do about it, you know, kind of a thing, which seems to be the new rules of diplomacy, frighteningly. But in theory, it's possible that if we went from 42 to 2800, the Europeans would have a legal claim in the international venue to say, hey, we'll take it at, you know, the French will say, hey, we'll take a bunch at 42, thank you. And the Germans will say, we'll take ours at 42, and so on and so forth, whoever else we may owe under those old claims from 1971. I don't know if that's true or not. I'm operating as if it's not true, but that could be part of the reason why we haven't.
Yeah. Yeah, it's fascinating. It's just always been odd to me. It's like, it's trading at this level, and yet we mark it at a way lower level. I'm wondering if it's just this poker chip we've been waiting to to pull out for a time like now, which gets
it's good. Very that's probably a better that's my base case is something like that. There's just basically been some dogma and then save it till you need it.
Yeah. And I mean, I guess that are you, it seems like based off of everything we've discussed over the last hour, I think times can get very volatile in the near to medium term, but the volatility is likely necessary to reset things and get on a better footing. Like, does it feel like we're reaching the rip the Band-Aid moment and it's time to confront the systemic issues that exist in the sovereign debt markets and the global financial system and just call a spade, figure it out, and move on?
Yeah, I think we're getting there. I think Trump's going to be a catalyst toward that. There's always been only one fix. three fixes, I guess. There's one of three fixes is a better way of saying it. You can default, say we're not paying it, write it all down. Practically speaking, that's not possible because that all that sovereign debt's the collateral of the banking system. So the banking system would collapse and that's not good. Okay, so default, nominal default's not an option. The next option is productivity miracle. It would have to be a productivity miracle that arrives neither too fast or too slow, because if it's so good that it creates unemployment, then that also is going to crash the system because unemployed people don't pay their mortgages, they don't pay their car loans, et cetera. Banks collapse that way too. So it has to be a Goldilocks productivity miracle. I don't see anything on the horizon that fits that actually, arriving at just the right amount of time because the debt is so high. The debt was lower. A lot of what we're seeing, I think, could be a Goldilocks productivity miracle. And then the final option is repress it, inflate it away, which is essentially you're going to need 2-3 years of 10-20%, -10 to 20% real rates, one way or another. You can do it all at once in a number of different ways. Yield curve control, revalue gold. You can do, there's a whole bunch of things you can do. But ultimately, they all involve and require a 2-3 year period of significantly negative real interest rates. And that would, especially if married with a transition of the system to a neutral reserve asset system where treasury bonds are no longer the primary reserve asset, but rather gold, Bitcoin, something like gold or Bitcoin is, which is another way of saying gold or Bitcoin, because I don't think there's anything like those two to do the job. Then that could be how you do the negative real interest rate. There's a whole lot of ways to do it, but one way, shape, or form, you've got to get -10 to 20% real rates for 2-3 years. And I think that's really the only way out of this thing. And we've gone through this period of five stages of grief around it, denial, anger, bargaining, depression, acceptance. And, I think we are out of the denial stage. The denial stage was probably a couple, 3 years ago as it related to the global sovereign debt bubble bursting. I hear lots of people talking about that now. Almost everybody I hear says, okay, yeah, it's a problem. There's still sort of the, somewhere between the anger, and the bargaining side of it, right? The anger of like, oh, you're anti-American, Luke, or you're a panda hugger, or all this stuff I hear, which, those people can piss off. I don't care. There's still some people in the anger stage. And now we're in sort of the bargaining stage. Well, maybe we can sort of, maybe Bessent can keep a strong dollar and keep the system as is and keep oil at 70 and bring our manufacturing back and put tariffs on and it'll all be fine. And you're like, no, that's the bargaining stage. The depression stage, I think, is still on the come, which is like, oh, God. And then there'll be acceptance, which is, hey, price of gold's a lot bigger. Price of Bitcoin's a lot bigger. Inflation's been higher for 2-3 years, and rates have been not that high. And wages in America are soaring, and GDP's soaring. And my treasury bond portfolio, which used to buy me a house, now buys me a car. And but at least my stocks are up a bunch. And that'll be the acceptance phase. And then we'll be in sort of a new golden era of growth, and debt to GDP will be a lot lower. And I think that's my base case is it works out in a really good way for the whole world in that way. China's has to grow more on their own consumption, and we have to produce more of our own, more of our own production. We have to produce more of our own consumption. The Chinese need to buy more of their own production. That's a world that can work. But there are fat tail risks that that goes horribly. Something goes horribly wrong between the world we're in now and that world. But that's how I'm thinking about it.
Yeah. No, I think that makes a lot of sense. It's just go with the path of least resistance, may create inflation or whatever, but we're not going to overtly default. It would be geopolitically unpalatable. Goldilocks, increase in productivity. Seems like we missed the ability to do that. Let's just bite the bullet, go with route three. And I think particularly here in the United States, and I do like the way Trump has been positioning things as it pertains to Bitcoin and the people that he's placing in positions of power. You just let the private sector figure out the recapitalization of whether it's the banking system or the credit system. And we're beginning to see that somewhat naturally. You're beginning to see dual collateralized commercial real estate products, which are using the building and Bitcoin as collateral. What MicroStrategy is doing to basically pull dollars into the convertible debt market and get that market access to better collateral in Bitcoin, which is held on MicroStrategy's balance sheet. The trend of private small businesses and even public businesses adding Bitcoin as a treasury asset, you're beginning to see this natural recapitalization of personal and business balance sheets with Bitcoin. And if that, you go route three and you just buy time for enough people to do that, you could wake up on the back end of this and be like, all right, we somewhat manufactured a soft landing by letting Bitcoin proliferate and people choose it as a treasury asset.
Yeah, there's like Bitcoin, it can absolutely play a role a number of different ways, right? I mean, you can do it with, you know, a Bitcoin sweetener. You can do it with gold too, but right? Like if, you know, one way to lower treasury costs, look, you offer a 2% yielding 30-year treasury with, you know, of the $1,000 face, $50 worth of Bitcoin valued where it is today, $100 worth of Bitcoin valued where it is today, $50 or $100 worth of gold valued where it is today, I might buy that bond, right? You could do something like that. Or, you know, that's a more subtle way of doing what we talked about before, which is just revalue the gold and buy back a block of treasuries. But yeah, you're absolutely seeing it in the private sector. And ultimately, you know, I think it's a very, you know, free market way of doing it, right? Ultimately, the people that own a lot of Bitcoin today, I think, are going to be rewarded for that over the next 2 to 3 years, probably pretty handsomely. And as they do that, their balance sheets will be in a position to do some of that recap. You know, you're essentially talking about a transfer of purchasing power from bondholders to treasury holders, or sorry, from bondholders, treasury holders to Bitcoin holders, excuse me. And like that's nature healing. That's efficient markets. So yeah, that the way you laid that out makes perfect sense. And obviously there's a lot of different, like you were saying, different financial ways to structure that, that I think make a lot of sense, that can be used to recollateralize different systems. I wrote a report a month and a half ago, kind of highlighting, it really surprised me, that the Treasury Borrowing Advisory Committee, or TBAC, which is like a consortium of the biggest, too big to fail banks that advise Treasury, they wrote a supplement to their quarterly TBAC report looking into how crypto and digital assets can support the Treasury market. I mean, to me, that was a huge mind-blowing moment. And of course, the key dynamic was, here's the market cap of total of crypto. And of course, most of that's Bitcoin, which is what I spend my time focus on. And here's the underlying growth in stable coins to support the growth in the aggregate market cap. And here's the growth and market share of US Treasury T-bills as a percent of those stable coin assets. And so the Treasury and TBAC are looking at that dynamic. It's not a big leap to say, look, they can regulate stable coins into saying you got to hold for every dollar in, you know, market cap you need to have in crypto, you need to have 20% of it in treasury T-bills. And let's just use Bitcoin, because again, it's the only one I focus on. Once you get to there, you know, think about what I just said. The fundamental problem of the of the Treasury, the fundamental solution is we need to financially repress bondholders, right? We need negative real rates. Well, problem is you can't find a sucker at the card table, private balance sheet, willing to take a negative 5 or negative 10% yield on their bond, right? And in this case, you could. You know, if Tether holds 0% yielding T-bills, and Bitcoin is allowed to go, I'm going to pick a big number for around easy math, but let's say Bitcoin's allowed to go to 500,000 a coin, or is bid to 500,000 a coin, 20 million coins, that's a $10 trillion market cap, 20% of that's in Tether. Okay, that's which has been the historical ratio, roughly. That's $2 trillion. And they've got to hold all their reserves in T-bills. It's $2 trillion of T-bill demand by Bitcoin going to $500,000. Great. Beautiful. Now the next year, send it to a million. There's another $2 trillion in T-bills. And it's T-bills at zero. Now, is Tether angry that they're only getting zero from the U.S. government? No, they're happy as pigs in crap because the price of Bitcoin's going up and they're catching fee, right? There's like it all works. Bitcoin holders are happy to be the implicit holders of those stable coins, of those T-bills at zero within the stable coins, because they're getting paid on the appreciation of their Bitcoin. And so it's a way of devaluing the dollar and financially repressing somebody in big ways, without it ever being called a big devaluation of the dollar and without it ever being called financial repression of somebody. I mean, you can find a lot of balance sheet that way in an ongoing basis without, I think, really calling into question the dollar system in any real way. And you can wake up in 2-3 years and if you do the right things on spending, et cetera, with a pretty reasonable sovereign balance sheet.
Yeah. And hopefully at that point, too, everybody from the geopolitical perspective, cooler heads prevail. Because we have whether it's AI or the embracing of energy and unleashing that, it seems like we were all able to figure out how to put the guns down and be happy with the debt situation and make sure nobody's getting screwed over and feed Bitcoin into the system, get back to a place where things aren't as heated as they are today. You don't have all this warmongering and saber rattling going on. It's just build stuff.
Yeah, it's either gold or Bitcoin or both. So that they're the Gordian, you know, they cut the Gordian knot that we're in, right? Which is the United States cannot afford its debt without negative real rates. We will mathematically default if our rates go below nominal growth. That's problem one, right? So it's a matter of national security. The Russians are saying it's a matter of national security for us to not store our surpluses in your paper, America, because you need negative real rates. Well, if we sell oil for negative real rate paper, we're going to wake up and our pile of paper isn't going to be, you know, at some point our oil fields will roll over and then we're going to need to use your paper, America, to go back and buy oil back that we sold. And we'd be buying back oil much more expensive because you've been inflating, right? That's what negative real rates is. You've been inflating and now our paper is worth a lot less or is worthless relative to oil and other things we need. And that's a matter of national security for us. So that's two untenables. And then you factor in a third untenable with China, who's saying, look, we're making stuff and selling it to you and you're sending us dollars and we can't afford to store those dollars in negative real rate paper. And so they've been doing a wise thing, which is buying stocks, buying ports, buying mines, buying oil fields, buying gold, buying sort of anything that's going to go up as the Americans inflate and leaving the Americans to buy their own negative real rate paper, primarily the boomers and the banks and the Fed. But the problem is that then slows down our economy. It's basically, you know, a tax, right? When your own people buy negative real rate debt, that means they're getting poorer on a real basis every year. And their disposable income's shrinking. And so that then keeps this vicious cycle of stronger dollar and more treasury selling, higher rates, this breakdown in the system. And the way you cut this Gordian knot, there's two ways, right? You go to world war and you duke it out and you see who's left standing, or you all agree this is untenable. Nuclear war is probably a bad idea. You know, if you want to do a proxy war first to see if people are really as tough as they are, and I think that might be what part of what Ukraine was about, and the Russians have acquitted themselves very well relative to NATO. In fact, they've massively outproduced us. Then you've got to find something to devalue against. You basically have to devalue the sovereign debt against. You have to move to a neutral reserve asset so that the creditors can get settled in something that maintains real purchasing power and then redeploy that into other countries. And it turns it from a vicious cycle of trying to steal money from each other with negative real rate debt as a settlement asset to paying each other by, you know, a virtuous cycle of trade of, hey, yeah, I'm going to sell my oil here. And then you're going to send me your currency. I'm going to buy Bitcoin or I'm going to buy gold. And as we inflate, because we have to, because we have these off balance sheet obligations, then, you know, the value of our gold or Bitcoin is going to go up and I'm going to buy more from you here and I'm going to invest more with you here. And it all can work in a virtuous way. So I hope there's an understanding of that. There seems to be an understanding of that. The reality is that, like, we've tried this sort of gentle financial repression, this whole let's just take 4-5%, 2-3% from bondholders over 5 or 8 years and we'll delever that way. We tried that. It didn't work. And so to me, the biggest variant perception out there right now is I hear this so much. Like, I don't want to buy gold or Bitcoin. I buy gold or Bitcoin when it's really obvious they're going to have to do this. Like, it's really obvious they're going to have to do this now. And you think you have time and you might not. Like, you know. To me, the biggest message of the Trump coin thing of last weekend and the Melania coin, that thing went up 12,000% in 12 hours. Like, there's a real chance, like, that's the friggin' playbook of, like, you know, well, I'll buy gold. I don't need gold if they're going to use gold. I'll just buy gold once it's obvious they're going to revalue it. Okay. What if they do it on Friday night, like they did with Trump coin, and you wake up and gold's up 1,000% by the time you're up on Saturday morning? What are you going to do? You're going to sell your bonds and buy gold on Saturday? Nope. Sunday? Nope. And oh, by the way, on Sunday, you know, who knows? Maybe they don't let you do that by Monday morning, you know, Sunday night open in Asia. I don't know. But that's the fact that we're so far gone. It almost has to happen on, you know, over a weekend, over a week, over a month, something very compressed. And the more I see, the more conviction I have that that's one way or another. Whatever reserve asset is the asset, I still think it'd probably be gold. But what I've seen in the last 6 months with Trump, you know, I would have said it was a tiny fraction of a percent of a chance it was Bitcoin. Like, that tail's getting fatter, a lot fatter for me in the last 6 months, that Bitcoin could have a real role in some way, shape, or form in this way, based on the actions of this administration. But one way or another, I think it's going to be a very compressed period of time.
Yeah, I agree. It has to be. And it is funny that you connected that Friday night Trump coin launch. Maybe that was just a testing of the waters. Like, see,
I mean, I don't think they have that much, you know, but I do think it's instructive. Like, you know, I have friends that grew up in Ukraine and, you know, they're American citizens now. And they tell me a story about, you know, the mid to late 90s. And they said, look, you know, we were the richest family in the village. My dad was a doctor. We had enough in the bank to buy 5 cars. And they closed the banks on a Friday night and they reopened them a week or two later. And we took the money out. And it was the same money. We got every dime back and we bought groceries for the month with the amount of money that used to buy 5 cars. Happens all the time. Like, the Americans are the only people in the world who don't think this kind of thing can happen. And it's only because it's been 100, 120, 130 years since it's happened anywhere in America. But this stuff happens all the time. Yeah. Happens all the time. And look, I'm not saying you should live your life like assuming it's going to happen, but if you're living your life assuming it'll never happen, I think that's folly. And that's why, at the very least, I think everybody should own a little bit of gold, a little bit of Bitcoin, and then, you know, you don't have to worry about this kind of thing. Because you'll be more than compensated. But the setup we're seeing, increasingly, you know, when you remove the impossible, whatever left, whatever remains, however improbable, must be the truth. It's the old Sherlock Holmes. Like, that's where we are. Once you remove what is impossible, you know, and it's like, okay, well, we've you know, we've run down the SPR a whole bunch, and then we've, you know, we've run down the reverse repo a whole bunch, and we've run down TGA, and, you know, we're already at 111% true interest expense. And, you know, we've already gone to war and it didn't go well in Ukraine. You know, NATO's getting outproduced 4-1 by the NATO Secretary General's own admission. And the Chinese have not tipped over with the dollar wrecking ball. In fact, the U.S. banks and the U.S. Treasury market have broken repeatedly before China has broke. Like, we've tried all this stuff. What's left? Do it quick. Do it over a weekend. Sign a deal.
Yeah.
Asset holders win. U.S. wins. Inflation wins. Gold wins. Bitcoin wins. You know, China gets what they want out of the deal. And like, we move on. And ultimately, if, you know, we can avoid a serious confrontation, we all win. That should be the goal. But I just really, the more this goes on, the more I think it's likely to be relatively compressed. And I don't think people think that that's even possible.
No. And every indication from Trump, I think he gets it. I mean, he's explicitly said the price of Bitcoin will be a KPI of his administration. And I think maybe not him, but at least people surrounding him in this new administration have to recognize that individual holders of Bitcoin per capita are U.S. is winning that KPI. And
oh, that's interesting. I didn't know that.
Yeah, I believe that's it was the case at some point in the last 5 years. I imagine it still is. But just think about the my company started here, and I think the U.S. for the first 16 years, U.S. citizens have participated pretty materially in Bitcoin and accumulating it and its appreciation. And if you were to do something overnight, like the collateral damage would not be as bad if as many Americans didn't own as much Bitcoin as we did. So you could totally see it playing out.
And yeah, you could see. I mean, yeah, there's been signals. I think even, you know, when Putin says no one can stop Bitcoin, I took that as a signal of sorts, right? Of yeah. Like, hey, like, we'll be all right with that.
And how much time are we going to waste just not recognizing the elephant in the room, confronting the problem? Like, I can't wait for the sigh of relief when it's Band-Aid's ripped off. Everything happens. It's like, all right, we've confronted the boogeyman, recognize that this was not sustainable. Now we're going to move on. And
feels like we're closer. You're seeing real world conversations about that. And, you know, it's interesting with the one thing, you know, about doing it via Bitcoin is that it would be much more, in my opinion, you know, a lot of times Bitcoin gets dinged for, oh, look at the distribution of holdings and what have you, whatever. But a lot of sort of legacy institutions can't hold it because the vol is so great, right? The volatility is so high, they simply can't hold it, which separate discussion. But it's point being that there's a lot, I think, a lot more individuals. It would be a really much better, it would recap more individual balance sheets per capita than simply, hey, you know, you revalued it and a bunch of, you know, Wall Street asset holders got rich on it. I don't think that's the case with Bitcoin, right? So I think it's a much more democratic, or a much more, it would recap a lot of individual balance sheets in a way that, you know, that would be helpful.
Yeah. No, and last thing on this topic, but the rescinding of SAB 121 last week by the SEC, maybe that's to pave the way to
allow. Yeah, it's interesting. I looked into that today. I saw Preston talking about it, and I was like, yeah, you know, I read up on what that was. And yeah, that's it's very possible.
Yeah.
Create, I mean, it certainly can't hurt, right? It's interesting that they're doing that.
Yeah. It creates an avenue for the banks to get access to this collateral asset, whether or not they're able to actually not blow it like BlockFi or Celsius or FTX did is another question. But you can envision a scenario in which they're allowed to hold Bitcoin on behalf of customers and on their balance sheets, and they have proper risk management and don't lend it out to degenerate gamblers and are able actually to keep it where it could be better for everybody involved.
Yeah, that would make sense to me.
Yeah. Luke, it's always a pleasure, sir. Thank you so much for taking some time on this Monday afternoon to sit down. Is there anything top of mind we didn't touch on that you think people should be aware of, or
do we? No, I think it, you know, it's very much in a state of flux. So it'll be, I think it'll be really interesting to see, the next several weeks how they play out, because it does, next 2-3 months, I have very little visibility how things are going. I'm sort of in a, the position of a poker player, right? And I'm, I got the cards I'm holding, and I know what I have in my hand, and I'm looking at what's been flopped so far, and it's like, I need to see a couple more cards before I get aggressive. I mean, I think I know how this game's going to end by the end of this year, but for the next 2-3 months, I need to see a few more cards and, let's see, because there's a lot of things in a state of flux, and there's some very strongly held opinions about how they're going to go. And I'm not sure how those opinions and how things actually go are going to match up in the next 2-3 months.
Yeah. Yeah. I think we have 1 month of honeymoon period post inauguration, and then things start to get real. So
then they're going to have to start, and that's where things will start to get much more interesting, like we said, right? When, Bessent starts sitting down and said, you have to go with us and cut off the Chinese. Like, they buy four times more stuff than you from us. What do you got? Like, well, how about some F-16s? How about an F-35, right? And it's like, you can only have so many F-35s if your people want smartphones, right? So we'll see how those negotiations go, among other things.
Well, we'll watch it all play out, and hopefully we'll catch up at some point, Q2. And see where things are landing.
Yeah, perfect.
All right, Luke, thank you. Have a great night.
Thank you, my friend. You do the same.
All right, peace and love, freaks.
Take care. All right, take care.